Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the July 9th / July 16th issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Joe Biden. He's balancing on one of those cables on a huge bridge like the Golden Gate Bridge. He's way above the deck of the bridge and, of course, above the water. He's got a little balance beam, balancing pole at the end of it. Either end of it are sacks of money, and he's in his typical dark blue suit without a tie and giving us his big smile. The headline is Balancing Act. Can Biden get two major infrastructure bills through a divided Congress? And that is one of our main stories, but we're going to opt for the second main story this week instead. Searching for answers after Florida condo collapse. What happened? Rescue teams intensified their search for survivors amid the wreckage of a collapsed Miami area condo tower this week, with some digging through the rubble with their hands, even as chances of anyone being found alive rapidly diminished. At least 16 people have been confirmed dead and nearly 150 remain missing following the unexplained cave-in of Champlain Tower South, a 13-story beachside condo in Surfside, Florida. We have people waiting and waiting and waiting, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Caba said of the families of the missing. This is excruciating. Constructed in 1981, the building abruptly crumbled as residents slept last week. Minutes before the collapse, one now missing resident told her husband over the phone that she saw the pool deck crater into the parking garage below. Then the line went dead. Another resident, Marian Lopez, opened the door of her sixth-floor apartment and saw sky and beach where her neighbor's doors once stood. That complete side of the building was not there, she said. An investigation into what may be the deadliest accidental building collapse in U.S. history is now underway. 3 years before the collapse, an engineer warned of a major error in the building's design. Waterproofing below the pool deck and entrance drive had been placed on a flat slab rather than a slope surface, allowing water to accumulate, and noted abundant cracking of beams and supporting columns, crumbling concrete, and the corrosion of steel reinforcements. A $12 million program to repair that damage was set to start soon. Structural engineers said other factors could have played a role in the collapse, including the gradual sinking of the reclaimed wetland underneath the building. What the editorial said. The sheer scale of this tragedy is hard to fathom, said the New York Daily News. The tower's residents came from at least half a dozen nations, including Argentina, Colombia, Israel, Venezuela. Among the presumed dead are aging snowbirds from parts of the north, young families building their lives. And for now, there seems to be no clear culprit, either individual or institutional. We'd be fools not to wonder whether South Florida's sordid history of shoddy building practices might be to blame, said the Miami Herald. The 1980s construction boom was an era of slipshod construction and look-the-other-way enforcement. Could faulty construction have allowed enough corrosive salt water and sea spray to penetrate the concrete and doom the building? Florida updated its building codes after the Hurricane Andrew destroyed some 25,500 homes in 1992. This disaster must serve as yet another turning point. what the columnist said. For Florida's largest metro area, the catastrophe has a very deep and terrifying resonance, said Steve Bosquet in the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. High-rise condos line our barrier beaches. They're as much a part of our collective psyche as air conditioning in the I-95. Our community has long prepared for hurricanes, but it's not clear we've paid enough attention to quieter threats such as subsidence. One recent study found Champlain Towers had sunk about 2 millimeters a year in the 1990s. The collapse will understandably cause a lot of anxiety for a lot of people for a long time. Investigators may find multiple causes behind this disaster, said Lizette Alvarez in the Washington Post. Residents said that construction at the condo building next door shook their apartments, and perhaps ongoing repairs to Champlain South's roof played a role. One thing is for sure, in Florida, water is always a prime suspect. The building's underground garage apparently routinely flooded with seawater. It's possible that a column, critically corroded by salt water, simply gave way and set off a structural avalanche. Climate change will only intensify Florida's water woes, said the economist. Sea levels around Miami are rising at an average of 9 millimeters a year, three times the global average, and ever more buildings will be exposed to the stresses they were not designed to withstand. Towers in Surfside currently need only be given thorough inspections every 40 years. In our age of rapid climatic change, more regular assessments and potential retrofits must be a priority for any coastal community. Controversy of the week is titled, The Border, Do Biden and Harris Have a Plan? Kamala Harris held out for as long as she could, said Mark Krikorian in NationalReview.com. But last week, Joe Biden's appointed border czarina finally caved to her critics and visited the U.S.-Mexico border. The vice president chose Democrat-run El Paso for her brief photo op 800 miles from the South Texas border at McAllen, where the disaster she and Biden have created is unfolding. But there is no hiding from the numbers. Since January, when Biden halted construction of the border wall and started repealing former President Trump's asylum policies, 900,000 migrants, including thousands of unaccompanied children, have been taken into custody at the border. That's double the 400,000 apprehended migrants in all of 2020, and it's only July. Somehow, Harris found the gall to try to blame this historic surge on Biden's predecessor, said John Davidson in nypost.com, claiming she and Biden inherited a tough situation. But the real explanation is straightforward. When you repeal policies like Trump's Remain in Mexico plan that successfully deter people from coming to the U.S., they will come. The Biden administration did, in fact, inherit a mess, said Maria Cardona in TheHill.com. Trump used the COVID-19 pandemic to block all asylum claims, and tens of thousands of migrants were penned up in squalid tent cities on the Mexican side of the border. Despite Trump's draconian policies, including separating children from their parents, migrants kept coming. Biden inherited a backlog in immigration courts of 1.3 million people and 350,000 pending asylum applications. Desperate migrants are willing to risk anything as they flee rampant crime, gang violence, and lack of jobs in Central America's Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. The actual job Biden gave Harris was to address the root causes of migration in Central America, so fewer people make that dangerous trek. Migrants arrive seeking physical safety, as is their right under U.S. and international law, said Nicole Naria in Vox.com. Some have been deported. Some are being held in jail-like detention centers to await asylum hearings. Thousands have been released into the U.S. while awaiting court dates. Now the administration needs to create a system for processing the asylum claims of families so they can be decided in a matter of weeks rather than years. Root causes, huh? Said Ruben Navarrete in thedailybeast.com. On Harris' recent trip to the region, her message to millions of desperate people whose countries are imploding was a simple do not come. Yes, the administration has proposed $4 billion in aid to Central America, but much of that money will only go to strengthen corrupt military and police that, far from keeping people safe, often help drive people out. Biden needs to go on offense, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. The administration actually is working hard to build a more efficient and compassionate asylum system, an effort that 71% of battleground state voters support, according to new polling. Those same polls, however, show Biden with a 57% disapproval rating on immigration. Why the huge discrepancy? With Fox News blaring scare stories about the crisis at the border, Democrats have been tentative and uncertain about touting their more humane immigration policies, lest it aid Republicans in riling up their nativist voters. But why try to appease nativists who want no immigration? It's time for Biden and the Democrats to focus on getting the policy right and stop worrying about the people who probably aren't going to vote for them anyway. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for ditherers after Popeyes, the fast chicken chain, introduced the I don't know meal for customers who for some reason can't decide what to order at Popeyes. The meal comprises a chicken sandwich and a premium lemonade. It was a good week for making lemonade. After the historic Western drought left drinking water in Sacramento tasting like dirt and algae, city officials said the water was safe and advised adding lemon if people find the taste unpleasant. It was a good week for getting a tinfoil hat after Fox News host Tucker Carlson said he'd found out that the National Security Agency was spying on his communications and is planning to leak them in an attempt to take this show off the air. The NSA called the claim untrue. But it was a bad week for the lost cause after the House voted 285-120 to remove from the Capitol Rotunda the statues of Confederate President Jefferson Davis and former Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice Roger Taney, author of the Dred Scott ruling that black people had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. It was a bad week for brogues after doctors told an Australian woman who woke up with an Irish accent following tonsil surgery that she may be stuck with the accent for life. It is just so sudden and so bizarre, said Angie Yen, 28, an Asian woman who has never been to Ireland. Finally, it was a bad week for privacy after a new study found that 1,715 stars in our immediate galactic vicinity have enjoyed an unobstructed view of Earth over the full course of human civilization. Hiding is not really an option, said study author Lisa Kaltenegger of Cornell University. And one short and other news piece before we move on. House will probe January 6th Capitol attack. The House this week approved a committee to investigate the January 6th Capitol insurrection, 1 month after Senate Republicans blocked an independent bipartisan probe. The 13-member House panel will have subpoena power and could force testimony from lawmakers who were in contact with former President Trump in the hours leading up to what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's resolution calls a domestic terrorist attack. Pelosi said she would name 7 Democrats and 1 Republican to the committee and let Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy suggest 5 panelists, though it's not clear the Republicans will participate. Though 35 House Republicans voted earlier for an independent probe, Only two joined Democrats to authorize the current plan. The title of our briefing is Baseball's Latest Cheating Scandal. The players in our national pastime have always looked for an unfair edge. Pitchers recently found a new one. How are players cheating? Pitchers have been doctoring the baseball with sticky stuff, baffling batters with enhanced pitches that can seem unhittable. Unlike the classic spitball, which pitchers began throwing more than a century ago, using Vaseline, KY jelly, or actual saliva to make the ball slip out of their hand and wobble unpredictably, the new trick relies on commercial substances that give pitchers improved grip. The stickiness enables pitchers to throw harder while maintaining control, and to increase their pitch's spin rate and make sliders, curveballs, and sinkers bend and dive like never before. The average pitcher this season is striking out one in every four batters, on par with all-time greats such as Sandy Koufax and Nolan Ryan. Major League Baseball began sending this year's game-used balls to a lab, finding suspicious dark amber-colored markings that are sticky to the touch on a majority of specimens. This could be the biggest scandal in sports, a team executive recently told Sports Illustrated. Why is this stuff so effective? Pitchers have always been allowed to use rosin, extracted from pine trees, to modestly improve their grips. In its unadorned state, a baseball is shiny and slippery, and nobody wants a fastball slipping from someone's hand and beaning a batter. In recent years, pitchers began lathering their arms with sunscreen and mixing that with rosin to form a stickier composite. Then they discovered concoctions of hair gel or spider tack, a glue meant for World's Strongest Man competitions, or pelican grip, made for bat handles. Pitchers sneak these foreign substances onto the mound in their gloves or on their jock straps, hat brims, shoelaces, or belt buckles. Had they gotten caught? Until recently, umpires mostly looked the other way, as did teams, rather than call attention to their own pitchers. But the stickiness of these new substances isn't subtle. A ball once stuck to a catcher's chest protector like Velcro, without consequence, and another team was spotted playing with a sticky ball in the dugout, laughing as it dangled from players' open palms. Trevor Bauer, now of the Los Angeles Dodgers, said in 2018 he'd done tests in a pitching lab and found that the new sticky substances enabled him to increase his spin rate enormously. If I used that stuff, I'd be the best pitcher in the big leagues, he said, but I have morals. In 2020, his spin suddenly climbed, and the once mediocre pitcher landed a contract paying him at least $38 million this season. Is cheating new? It goes back to the dawn of pro baseball. In the 1910s, Chicago White Sox pitcher Eddie Cicotti threw a signature shine ball coated with talcum powder hidden in his pants pocket. Mid-20th century greats like Gaylord Perry, Whitey Ford, and Joe Niekro were well-known mound scientists, lubing up spitballs or scuffing the ball with secret emery boards or sharpened belt buckles and wedding rings to make pitches break unexpectedly. In 1980, Seattle Mariners pitcher Rick Honeycutt forgot he'd taped a thumbtack to his finger and accidentally gashed his face. What about batters? They've used plenty of their own tricks. Six sluggers since 1970 have been busted for using a corked bat, drilling a hole in the end of the bat and filling the barrel with cork, making a large bat lighter and thus easier to swing. During the steroid era in the 1990s and early 2000s, hitters used performance-enhancing drugs to build massive Popeye-like forearms and biceps. Sluggers such as Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, and Barry Bonds grew so massive they could hit the ball out with a flick of the bat and shattered virtually all home run records. Then there's the art of stealing catcher's signs to the pitcher. Legal if players on the field simply use their eyesight, but against the rules when teams use technology. The Houston Astros 2017 championship was marred when it emerged that the Astros used an outfield camera hooked up to a video monitor to steal signs, relay them to the dugout, where players or team staff banged on a trash can to tell batters whether to expect a fastball, breaking ball, or a changeup. Can MLB stop the cheating? Starting last week, the league began threatening 10-game suspensions for any pitcher caught using foreign substances. Umpires began searching every pitcher's hat, glove, and hands during games, to the irritation of some pitchers. Oakland reliever Sergio Romo sarcastically dropped his pants while being searched. The crackdown seems to be working. The average pitch spin rate has dropped to its lowest level all season, and some pitchers, including Bauer, have become noticeably more hittable. After Tampa Bay ace Tyler Glasnow tore his elbow ligament, he blamed it on the new rules enforcement, saying he had to grip the ball tighter. "I had to change everything I'd been doing the entire season," he complained. "You can't just tell us to use nothing. It's crazy." And we'll move on to the columns. We'll start with two from the U.S. Greg Sargent of the Washington Post writes, "How Barr incriminates himself." After he went to extraordinary lengths to help Donald Trump corrupt the presidency, William Barr is working overtime to launder his post-Trump reputation, said Greg Sargent. In an interview with The Atlantic's Jonathan Carl, the former attorney general says he quickly concluded that Trump's claim of massive election fraud was all BS, and that he told this to a red-faced, infuriated Trump in an Oval Office meeting. What Barr leaves out of this self-serving account is that before the election, he warned that mail-in ballots could be used by foreign governments to steal the election from Trump, and that after the election, he ordered U.S. attorneys to open baseless election fraud investigations for one reason, to placate Trump. Barr also admits that at the behest of then-Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he agreed to publicly state that the election was over so that McConnell and other Republicans would not have to. Why? McConnell feared that an angry Trump would punish him by undermining GOP chances in Georgia's Senate runoffs. Barr's clumsy attempt to exonerate himself only proves what a blatant partisan he was and strengthens the case for a fuller fumigation of Trump's effort to subvert the election. Yes, there is racial progress. The sentencing of Derek Chauvin marked a somber but important milestone of progress, said Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, Politico.com. It should not be remarkable that the former Minneapolis police officer was ordered last week to serve 22 and a half years in prison for killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for nearly 10 minutes. But for decades, police have been able to beat or kill black men without fear of consequences. In 1992, a video captured Rodney King being savagely beaten by four police officers, yet all four were acquitted. Los Angeles erupted into historic days of civil unrest. Afterward, white America largely doubled down on its support of aggressive policing in black and brown communities. But Floyd's gruesome murder shook America out of its long racial lethargy. And millions of people of all races marched last year in the nationwide Black Lives Matter protest. Chauvin's trial ended with a swift, all-counts conviction, a tough sentence, and no further turmoil. Clearly, there's much more work to be done on police violence, but most Americans came to see Floyd as a human being who deserved empathy, and his murder by a cop as an abomination that demanded justice. That shift in perspective is simple, but radical. This is an international column from Pakistan. Finally saying no to America. With two words, Prime Minister Imran Khan has put America in its place, said Maliha Hashmi. As the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan after 20 years of war, it has been badgering Pakistan to let CIA drones be stationed on our soil for counterterrorism operations. When asked for the billionth time during a recent interview whether he would allow such a deployment, Khan replied, "Absolutely not." The Americans should take him at his word. Khan campaigned on getting Americans out of Pakistan, and since he was elected in 2018, he has allowed no drone strikes here. We've already paid an unbelievably high price in America's so-called war on terrorism. At least 100,000 Pakistanis have died in this futile conflict, and our country has suffered an estimated $118 billion in economic losses. Over the past few years, we've gone to great lengths to protect ourselves against militant incursions from Afghanistan, even building a double chain link fence topped with barbed wire coils along all 1,640 miles of our border, and allowing U.S. drone launches could jeopardize that newfound safety. Most of all, Khan wants regional stability to ensure that a $62 billion package of Chinese-funded infrastructure projects will go ahead. The old Pakistan that bowed to the U.S. is gone. The Last Word article this week is a little bit of a tragic story. The title is Stolen by the Sea. 12-year-old Arune Pruti was swept out to the ocean by a sneaker wave, says Nora Mishinek in the San Francisco Chronicle. One of many casualties of a little understood Northern California coastal hazard. Upon reaching the bottom of the steps leading to Cowell Ranch State Beach, 8-year-old Siddhant Pruti grabbed a fistful of sand and turned to his older brother, Arune. Ahead lay the Pacific Ocean and an afternoon free of the pandemic's confinements. "Dubai," Siddhant said, addressing his 12-year-old brother with a Bengali term of endearment. "This is a bad beach." He was referring to the rocks in the sand, nothing more. The boy's parents walked over to greet their cluster of friends camped near the base of the cliff. The tight-knit pandemic bubble of four families often met along Northern California's San Mateo County coast on weekends. This was the Fremont family's first time at this secluded cove. Sharmisha and Tarun Pruti chatted with the others while pitching a tent they had brought to shelter themselves from the mid-afternoon sun on a warm January day. The beach was full of families. They didn't think anything of their youngest son approaching the water's edge to feel the cold surf graze his feet. But the wave that came next wasn't ankle-deep as previous waves had been. This one blasted Sinhot as he tried to run from it, first knocking him down, then dragging him under. In the split second it took for Sharmishta and to turn around, husband Tarun was already sprinting into the ocean. Sharmishta ran after him. She could feel the sand shifting beneath her feet as she threw herself into the water toward her husband and son. Rocked by the force of the oncoming waves, soon all three were immersed in the churning water. After several attempts to propel himself toward Sinhot during the lull between the waves, Tarun could not reach his son. Sharmishta managed to grab hold of Sinhot's hand, but only for a moment, losing her grip as one wave after another crashed over them. Sharmishta said she thinks she lost consciousness underwater. On the beach, friends and strangers linked arms to form a human chain. Somehow the group hauled the family onto the sand. Sinhot, then Tarun, and finally Sharmishta. Tarun and Sharmishta lacked the strength to stand, but they had survived. Arune is keeping his head above water, someone told him. The statement struck Tarun as odd. Arune wasn't in the water. Sharmishta, surrounded by the strangers who she said had saved her life, regained her senses and stood. What she saw as she looked toward the ocean made her want to rush back in. I saw his head, she said. I knew who it was. Unbeknownst to the parents, as their attention was focused on saving Sinhot, another huge wave had hit the shoreline and swept Arune into the ocean. Tarun called out to Arune, but he knew it was too late. A rip current was pulling the boy farther and farther away. Dispatcher's notes in the 911 call log only hint at Tarun and Sharista's agony as they watched their son in the violent surf. Too far out for anyone on the beach to get him, a dispatcher noted after speaking with the bystander. 3 minutes later, trying to stay adrift. 3 minutes later, starting to go under for longer periods of time. Nearly 2 hours after they had last seen their son in the water, the parents left the beach at the urging of San Mateo County Sheriff's deputies. It was dark as they ascended the wooden stairs to the overlook and walked to the parking lot to be interviewed for a police report and await word on their son. A U.S. Coast Guard helicopter whirred overhead, its roving searchlights trained on the ocean. In the place where Arune had been, the lights found only the sea. In the 7 weeks before the Pruthi's family visit to the coast on January 18th, 7 people had been fatally swept from Bay Area beaches into the Pacific Ocean. On November 26th, the afternoon of Thanksgiving Day, 4-year-old Catherine Huashun Zhu of Pinole died after being dragged into the surf on a family outing at McClure's Beach at Point Reyes National Seashore. Her father charged in after her and survived. The waves carried Catherine's body back to the shore 45 minutes later. On December 8th, a handyman was on a break from a job in Pacifica when a wave snatched him from the rocks beneath the municipal pier. The season's horror intensified on January 3rd when 3 members of a Petaluma family were killed at Blind Beach in Jenner. Michael Wyman, 40, drowned while trying to save his 2 children, 7-year-old Anna and 4-year-old John, who had been swept out to sea. Rescuers recovered Wyman's body that day. The children's bodies were recovered 2 weeks later. The next Sunday, January 10th, saw 2 more deaths. First, a wave pulled 3 friends into the ocean beneath Point Bonita Lighthouse at the Marine Headlands. Only 2 made it back to shore. Less than 1 hour later, 40 miles down the coast at Pescadora State Beach, a wave overtook Zunzi He and her husband as they looked for sea urchins. The husband washed back to shore and survived. Zunzi, her waders filling with water, was pulled under. Witness descriptions of the wave that pitched the Arune into the surf bore the hallmarks of a sneaker wave. Called extreme run-up events by scientists, they catch victims by surprise dragging them into the ocean as the ground beneath their feet suddenly becomes inundated. Researchers at Oregon State University wrote in a 2018 paper, one of the first attempts to define the phenomenon. Anyone who has spent time along the Northern California coast has probably experienced waves that arrive during periods of calm and travel far higher up the shore, swamping chairs and towels and sandcastles that had seemed well out of harm's way. Sneaker waves similarly catch beachgoers off guard, but are rare events that strike with much more water and with the force to knock adults off their feet. In any given year, the Bay Area may see one or two sneaker wave deaths, but the period from November to January was deadlier than any stretch authorities had seen before. And they knew the reasons. An unusually high number of sneaker waves, a warm spell caused by La Nina weather, and a flood of families using beaches to escape the pandemic shutdown. H. Tuba Ozkin-Holler, a professor of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University and an expert in wave mechanics and nearshore hydrodynamics, said she had not heard of sneaker waves until she moved to Oregon 20 years ago. They affect a subset of coastal areas where the continental shelf is too narrow to provide a buffer from powerful waves unleashed by oceanic storms. Aside from Northern California, Oregon, and Southern Washington, Ozkin-Holler knows of only one other area with similarly hazardous submarine topography, Iceland. No single agency tracks sneaker wave deaths year to year. One reason for the lack of data, experts shy away from labeling what is and isn't a sneaker wave unless they witness the event. Deaths like RNA's are rarely attributed to sneaker waves. State parks labeled his disappearance an aquatic incident. The National Weather Service called it a high surf death, referring to category of warnings in effect that day. Near the stairs leading down to the beach where RNA was last seen is a small blue sign that reads, Tsunami Hazard Zone, accompanied by the image of a cartoon person scrambling to escape an oncoming wave. There is no sign warning against sneaker waves, which strike Bay Area beaches with far greater regularity than tsunamis. Tarun and Sharmista never imagined they would lose one son and almost lose another to a phenomenon they hadn't heard of. In the aftermath, they wanted two things: to find his body, and to make sure no parent lost a child the same way again. Tarun and Sharmista left and checked into a room at the Half Moon Bay Lodge after 10 p.m. The parents hugged their son, said aunt goodbye. Go with auntie for the night, but then return to Cowell. They brought a blanket and a backpack full of dry clothes for RNA. He might be waiting on the beach. When they descended the staircase, they encountered two strangers who had heard a boy was missing and were searching the sand. Tarun and Sharmista joined them, roaming the quarter-mile stretch before heading back to the hotel after midnight. After daybreak, the helicopter returned. Coast Guard search and rescue teams used computer modeling to calculate how long a person in distress can survive in open water, accounting for the age and body type. Using real-time data from ocean buoys, the teams try to predict where a person would drift. To avoid unnecessary danger to rescuers, a mission coordinator helps make the decision to end searches when there is no hope. 3 hours after resuming operations in the morning, two Coast Guard representatives met the Pruthys at the hotel. There was, they explained, little chance of finding the boy alive. They were showing us drawings and data and all the research, Tarun said. They gave us a bunch of papers. The parents could not believe their son was lost. To them, RNA was still the boy at the dinner table who had, less than 2 weeks earlier, compared the Capitol Hill riot to the plot of Animal Farm. The son whose interest in politics had grown in the months since his mother took him to a Black Lives Matter protest. The soccer fanatic, the child who alternately fought and played with his younger brother when the coronavirus shrank their worlds overnight. At 10:20 a.m. on January 19th, after 17 hours, the Coast Guard called off its search. The San Francisco Bay Area coast stretches 148 miles from the mouth of the Gualala River in Sonoma County to the jutting ledge of Año Nuevo Point in San Mateo County. Over millions of years, the surging Pacific has marked its terraced cliffs with coves and caves. After the official search had ended, the Pruthi's circle of friends planned to continue on. One, Manish Saxena, set up a fundraising website and a Facebook page called Search for Arune Pruthi that within days gained thousands of followers and more than $200,000. Acquaintances and strangers contributed from as far away as India and Germany. The family hired helicopters to fly low as Eric Jones, a paramedic who had once pulled victims of the September 11th attacks from the Pentagon, and other volunteers peered into each cove to scan for Arune's white shirt. A drone operator, meanwhile, took tens of thousands of thermal camera scans of the water. A boat with a sonar tracking device scanned the seafloor. Each day brought them closer to the six-week cutoff point at which it becomes unlikely a body will resurface. The volunteers who returned to the water day after day said they sought to give the Pruthi family one thing, closure. For Tarun, the hardest part of moving on was knowing his son's death could have been prevented. Shortly after the couple moved to California from Maryland, they took Arune to the beach in Half Moon Bay, not far from where he would vanish 9 years later. Siddhant was not yet born. The family didn't even think to take sweaters that spring day in 2012, Tarun said. In their mind, the California coast evoked images of beach balls and children splashing in the surf. California school children regularly rehearse for earthquakes and practice fire drills, yet few leave school with a commensurate respect for the dangers of the ocean. We just didn't know, Tarun said. We didn't even think that this could happen. In early March, Arune's parents commissioned one last flight to look for his body. The helicopter scanned the coast from Bodega Bay to Big Sur. Through the window in the cockpit, Jones pointed binoculars into every cove, hoping for any sign of a body, a T-shirt, a clue. The day was exceptionally calm. The shadow of the spinning blades danced on the ocean as the helicopter flew over the craggy pinnacles that jut from the water near Cowell Ranch State Beach. The pilot hovered over the place where Arune was last seen as Jones opened the door and let go of a bouquet. White roses, lilies, and snapdragons bound with twine. The flowers hit the water and disappeared. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle. Here's a couple of the short health and science pieces. Aging can't be defeated. Bad news for all those Silicon Valley executives hoping to live forever. An international study of unprecedented size has concluded that the aging process is, sadly, unstoppable. The research, a collaboration of scientists from 14 countries, tested the invariant rate of aging hypothesis. This holds that a species ages at a relatively fixed rate once it reaches adulthood. The researchers compared age-specific birth and death data from a diverse set of human populations, including peoples from the 17th to the 20th century, and from 30 human primate populations, non-human primate populations, including chimpanzees and monkeys. They found that the pattern of mortality was the same across the board. The risk of death is high in infancy, drops and remains low until early adulthood, then starts to rise again. That suggests humans are living longer, not because they're delaying the aging process, but because more and more people are surviving the high-risk period of infancy. The trajectory toward death in old age has not changed. Evolutionary biology trumps everything, and so far, medical advances have been unable to beat these biological constraints. Coffee versus liver disease. Drinking 3 or 4 cups of coffee a day can cut your risk of developing and dying from chronic liver diseases, a new study found. Researchers looked at about 11 years of data on the liver health of some 495,000 people in the UK, ages 40 to 69, 385,000 of whom were coffee drinkers. After taking into account factors such as body mass index and alcohol consumption, the researchers found that those who drank any amount of coffee had a 20% lower risk of developing chronic liver disease or fatty liver disease than those who didn't drink the brew, and a 49% lower risk of dying from chronic liver disease. The positive effect increased as consumption rose up to 3 or 4 cups of Joe a day. People who sip caffeinated and decaffeinated ground coffee had the biggest risk reduction. But instant coffee drinkers also saw some benefits. Coffee is widely accessible, co-author Oliver Kennedy from the University of Southampton tells CNN.com. The benefits we see from our study may mean it could offer a potential preventative treatment for chronic liver disease. And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled, UFOs, the truth is still out there. After months of heated anticipation and leaks, the Pentagon has finally released a task force's report into unidentified flying objects, said Daniel Politi in Slate.com. And its big conclusion is that there is no conclusion. The task force focused on 144 reports by military pilots since 2004 of encounters with UFOs, or as the military calls them, UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. The study found no evidence the UAPs were alien spacecraft, but offers no good explanation for what they may have been. The report essentially casts doubt on the 4 possible explanations: a secret technology from an adversary, our own classified technology, airborne clutter such as weather balloons, and natural atmospheric phenomena. That leaves a 5th category, the suggestive catch-all, other. The government's striking admission that it can't explain the sightings is sure to fuel conspiracy theorists and people convinced of the existence of extraterrestrial life. The report offers one particularly startling finding, said Gideo Lewis Krause in NewYorker.com. It said 80 of the sightings involved observation with multiple sensors and concluded that these UFOs were actual physical objects. And 18 of these objects demonstrated inexplicable capabilities, such as maneuvering abruptly or moving at intense speeds without obvious means of propulsion. The presence of 18 such recent cases seems to suggest that other might not, after all, be a negligible bin. These sightings probably have mundane explanations, said former Harvard University astronomy chair Avi Loeb in ScientificAmerica.com. But we can't rule out that they are spacecraft from alien civilizations so far advanced that their technology looks magical to us. It's time for the scientific community to take a closer look by intensively studying the sky with our finest detection devices and computers. Come on, said David Axe in DailyBeast.com. We may not know what these objects are, but we can say with reasonable certainty that they're not what they're not, and that's aliens. Why would extraterrestrials travel galactic distances to Earth, fly loop-de-loops around military jets, and then zip away without making any effort to communicate? After decades of unanswered questions, Will this mystery ever be solved? Asked astronomer Seth Shustek in NBCNews.com. If you're disappointed, take solace in the fact that the story is not over. And despite the fervent hopes of many, I'm not sure it will ever be. Britney Spears, a life controlled by others. Britney Spears has long been one of the most watched people on earth, said Spencer Kornhaber in TheAtlantic.com. But it's different to be heard. In a recorded court hearing, the 39-year-old singer spoke out last week for the first time about living under a strict conservatorship. Several public meltdowns led to her involuntary institutionalization in a mental hospital in 2008, after which a judge gave her father legal control over her life. But 13 years later, Spears' chilling testimony includes that she was forced to take lithium, a sedating medication often used to treat bipolar disorder, and that her father, who draws a $16,000 monthly salary from her while giving her a $2,000 weekly allowance, controls everything from her kitchen decor to whether she can marry her boyfriend. No, she may not. She alleges that she is even forbidden from having her IUD implant removed to prevent her from having more children. I'm not happy, she testified. I cry every day. Spears testified that her lawyer hadn't told her she had the right to challenge the conservatorship, said Christy DeZarilla in the Los Angeles Times. Now she knows and wants out. Cut and dried, right? Not exactly. Legal experts doubt that she can be freed without a thorough medical evaluation and a court hearing that allows the other side to present its case could conclude that she remains a danger to herself or others. This wouldn't have happened to the male version of Britney Spears, said Helene Olin in the Washington Post. Michael Jackson, Kanye West, and Robert Downey Jr. all had severe mental health episodes or major drug problems. No one took away their autonomy or seized control of their reproductive systems. It's not just her father and a judge who robbed her of agency, said Jessica Goldstein in TheNewRepublic.com. Middle-aged men at a record company launched her career as a hypersexualized 16-year-old Lolita singing Baby One More Time, and various males steered her into a level of global pop stardom that generated $60 million in revenue, but left her constantly swarmed by paparazzi and gossip mongers. Only when she unraveled under incredible pressure was she deemed responsible for the mess she was in. It's time to free Britney Spears and return her story to its rightful owner. DeSantis, champion of academic free speech. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a chilling bill last week giving him the right to police free speech at state universities, said Eric Lutz in VanityFair.com. The new law requires public colleges and universities to survey students, faculty, and staff each year to find out whether competing ideas and perspectives are presented, that is, conservative ideas DeSantis agrees with. Arguing that colleges have become intellectually repressive environments, force-feeding students socialism, Marxism, and false history like the 1619 Project, DeSantis claims he's protecting free speech on campus. His authoritarian survey will do just the opposite, said Sarah Jones in nymag.com. DeSantis threatened that if survey results disappoint him and the Republican legislators, budget cuts could be looming. At least DeSantis is an honest warrior with a clear goal, punishing speech he doesn't like. Actually, the survey will address a real problem, said Scott Shackford in Reason.com. It will gauge ideological diversity on campus and whether people feel free to express their beliefs. Isn't that how liberals would describe the bedrock ideals of higher education? Critics of DeSantis claim he's out to punish liberal professors, but the entire First Amendment and a bunch of Supreme Court case law clearly protects professors' right to say whatever they want. But on many campuses, intellectual repression is becoming the norm, with some rather mainstream ideas and beliefs being deemed microaggressions or hate speech that must be silenced. A recently exposed University of Oklahoma training session encouraged professors to tell students, "You don't have the right to say that. Stop talking right now." Is that really how we want taxpayer-supported colleges to operate? What a hypocrite DeSantis is, said Charles Pearson, Esquire.com. He recently signed a law banning critical racial theory from being taught in Florida public schools. How's that for intellectual diversity? DeSantis is an opportunistic charlatan who knows that ginned-up hysteria over imaginary educational boogie folk will play well on Fox News. After impressing conservatives by keeping most of Florida open during the pandemic, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com, DeSantis is throwing more red meat to the Trump base with his attack on colleges. DeSantis is running neck and neck with former president in 2024 straw polls, and it's clear that DeSantis is actively positioning himself to be the rightful heir to Trumpism. And we'll finish up with a quote from philosopher Simone Weil, quoted in the Arizona Republic, who says, "Attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity." I like that one. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.